And one choice is, well, how do you pick the next variable to assign a value? And a heuristic which appears in almost every SAT solver is the unit clause heuristic, which says if there is a clause of size 1, we choose that clause. Because, if there's a clause of size 1, we have to set that variable a specific way to satisfy it. We have no other choices, so let's just do it right away. And for this talk, we're going to assume that if we don't have one, we're just going to assign a variable at random. So this is a very simple version of DPLL. So let me show what we know about random SAT. First is that there is a satisfiability threshold conjecture. This states that what the question asks is there a specific value in the clause density such that if we have a random formula where the density is below this value, we're almost surely satisfiable, and if we're above the value, we're almost surely unsatisfiable. We don't know if such a threshold even exists. We do know that there's a sharp transition here, but we think it's 4.2, but it may not be an exact value. It might actually wobble as n goes to infinity. So we can't actually prove that. And the bounds that we can prove is that we're almost surely satisfiable up to 3.52, and once we get to 4.506, we're almost surely unsatisfiable. Now, for 2SAT, there is an exact threshold. That's been proven, but for anything above 2, we just don't know. Now, DPLL, when it works, if you remember, it's as it satisfies a value, it removes that variable from clauses, so we end up with clauses of mixed sizes. So a model that is very useful when analyzing DPLL is something called the 2 plus P SAT model, and this form is a mixture of clauses. So it's just like the original model in that we have n variables, m clauses, but now P is going to be the proportion of 3 clauses versus 2 clauses in my model. So we're going to have P 3 clauses and 1 minus P 2 clauses. And I'm already using these terms, so I just should tell you that when I say a 3 clause, I just mean a clause of size 3. A 2 clause is a clause of size 2. And of course, there's an obvious conjecture that 2 plus P SAT has an exact satisfiability threshold. We know it's true if P is equal to 0. We don't know the answer if P is equal to 1. We don't know much about in between. We know a little bit, which I will show on the next slide. So here's some known results. The first is that if we run DPLL plus the unit clause on SAT, it's linear if we have up to 8/3 n clauses, but once we get up to 3.81 n clauses, we're exponential. So we have this gap in what we know as far for the running time. And this turns out that this comes from this very interesting and nice theorem, which says that if the 2 clauses are satisfiable, we can add up to 2/3 and 3 clauses without changing the satisfiability of the formula, almost surely. But once we add 2.28 3 clauses, then this formula is almost surely unsatisfiable. So again, we have this gap between the number of 3 clauses we can add, and the conjecture is that this lower bound is actually tight. The conjecture is that we can add up to 2/3 and 3 clauses, and the formula is going to stay satisfiable. But once we add more than 2/3 and 3 clauses, it goes unsatisfiable. Now, just so you know that, the formula specifically is for any delta there exists in epsilon. So I'm going to have deltas and epsilons, but I'm not always going to remember to say that or to point this out. But just keep it in your mind so that way some of these results don't seem quite as trivial as they might look otherwise. Now, why am I looking at XOR SAT? Well, XOR SAT is a variation of SAT, and it turns out that we can solve a lot of these problems that are open in SAT. Now, just to remind you what XOR SAT is, it's the variation, but we're going to use exclusive OR on each of the clauses. So that's equivalent to saying in SAT, it was saying we need at least one true literal. In XOR SAT, you're saying we need exactly one or exactly 3 true literals in each clause. Now, XOR SAT is in P, so you might think that, well, because it's in P, that's why we can solve these problems. But actually, the complexity has nothing to do with it, because it turns out we can generalize this problem to an NP-complete problem. And all these results still hold. Another thing you might ask is, why am I looking at DPLL on XOR SAT when we have this polynomial time algorithm? Well, there's two reasons. The first I just mentioned is that we can generalize this to an NP-complete problem, which we want to solve. And the second reason is that in industrial problems, it turns out that there's a lot of XOR clauses inside their 3SAT problems. And the people doing these solvers, they don't want to stop and solve the XOR SAT differently. They want DPLL to work. Now, the key idea that allows me to generalize to an NP-complete problem is looking at these clauses in a 3 XOR SAT formula. There are 8 possible clauses, but it turns out they each correspond to one of two different quasigroups of size 2. And in fact, these are the only two quasigroups of size 2. Quasigroups are also known as Latin squares, if you've heard that term. And basically, we can think of this as a multiplication table. We have x, y, and z is the value here. So if x is set to 0, y is 0, then z has to be 0 for this quasigroup. And a quasigroup, or a Latin square, simply says that along each row, along each column, we have a permutation. So the idea is that we're going to increase the domain that our variables can take, so they can no longer take 0, 1. We're going to increase the size, and now that's going to increase the number of quasigroups we can choose from. So here is the generalized problem. I call it UECSP, which is short for Uniquely Extendable Constraint Satisfaction Problem. K is going to be the domain, is going to be the size of the clauses. D is the domain size, and each constraint is uniquely extendable, which just says that each constraint, if you're dealing with size 3, each constraint is a quasigroup. I use uniquely extendable because that's the key feature of quasigroups, which allows all of these theorems to work. We can show some complexity results. So if we use quasigroups up to size 3, we stay in P, but once we get quasigroups of size 4, we become NP complete. This is a reduction from 3 coloring. And we can also prove the exact satisfiability threshold for this problem. This was proven for XORSAT by Dubois and Mandler and by Mike Malloy and myself for this more general problem. And so already we can do some things on XORSAT and on uniquely extendable CSPs that we could not for SAT. So when we're looking at the techniques to solve this, one of the basic techniques we use is to consider all these formulas as random graphs. So the way we're just going to, just the obvious translation, which is each variable of our formula is now a vertex of our graph, each clause is now a hyperedge. And so the random model we're considering on these problems is just, let's choose a random hypergraph uniformly, randomly. And now for our constraints on each hyperedge, let's just pick from all the quasigroups of that size uniformly, randomly. So that's the model that we're using. And here is the theorem that we're going to prove. On a uniformly random instance of uniquely extendable CSP, or 3XORSAT, if you will, on n variables and cn clauses, DPLL plus unit clauses can take linear time if we're up to 2/3 n clauses. But once we exceed 2/3 n clauses, we're going to take exponential time. We also, from that, we get this nice theorem, which states that if the two clauses are satisfiable, we can add up to 1/6 and 3 clauses, and we're still satisfiable, but the moment we add more than 1/6 and 3 clauses, we become unsatisfiable. So this is a similar theorem to what we had in SAT, but we had a gap there, and here we can close the gap. And I want you to notice with DPLL, the bound between linear and exponential time is at 2/3 n, where the satisfiability threshold is at 0.917935. So DPL with unit clause goes exponential while we're still well below the satisfiability threshold. So all these formula are almost surely satisfiable. So I'm going to prove the first theorem, and the second theorem is going to fall out of that proof. And there are four basic steps that we're going to use. The first one is just to show that if the clause density is at most 2/3, we're going to actually solve the problem in linear time. In fact, we're going to show that with uniform positive probability, DPLL is going to find the satisfying assignment without any backtracking at all. The second point is we're going to show that once the clause density is higher than 2/3, we're going to, yes. With uniform positive probability, it means as n goes to infinity, the probability is bounded below by a constant that does not depend on n. So if c is greater than 2/3, DPLL with the unit clause is going to produce a random subformula with this density. So it's going to be 1/2, slightly less than 1/2, 2 clauses, slightly more than 1/6, and 3 clauses. The epsilon and delta do matter, because it's going to be here where we're going to prove that such a formula is unsatisfiable. And finally, we have to then prove that DPLL is going to take exponential time to backtrack out of this unsatisfiable subformula. So let's start with step one, which is to prove that we're going to find a satisfying assignment without backtracking. And the technique is to use differential equations to model the behavior of the DPLL algorithm. And specifically, we're just going to look at unit clause alone. We're going to get rid of DPLL because we're not going to backtrack anyway. So you don't have to worry about the values here, but all we do is we're looking at the expected change in the number of three clauses at any one step in the algorithm and the expected change in the number of two clauses. Now, this was done originally on SAT by Akleoptis, Karousis, Kronakis, and Krasenk, and so I'm just using the same technique on XORSAT. And we had this nice lemma by Nick Wormald, which says that if we solve these differential equations, we get the almost sure behavior of the algorithm up to a linear number of steps. So we can't go all the way to termination, but as long as we stop and there's still a linear subformula left, we get the almost sure behavior. So we need a couple of small observations to get this to work. The first is that until we have a backtrack, the subformula produced at each step of the algorithm is uniformly random. That's one reason we can analyze unit clause, and we can analyze a lot of other heuristics, but they can't get too complicated. We have to make certain that we don't learn too much of the rest of the graph so we stay uniformly random. Now, DPLL is only going to backtrack on a contradiction, so if we have no contradictions, then we're going to stay uniformly random. And this next lemma just says that if we bound the number of two clauses at any one step, then with uniform positive probability, we're going to reach some step T0 at the far distant future without producing a contradiction, and in addition, there will be no unit clauses at that step. So there's a good chance we're going to get somewhere, we're not going to produce any contradictions, and we're going to have no unit clauses to take care of. So the final thing we're going to do is just simply pick gamma small enough so that way the formula that's left is so simple any algorithm is going to solve it with uniform positive probability, not even something as, you know, advanced as unit clause. So let's get back to the differential equations. So we simply take our set of equations and we add this bound that we want to restrict the number of two clauses. And now let's just plug in. The initial value for the three clauses is C. We have no two clauses, and let's solve. And what we see is that as long as C is at most two-thirds, then we're not going to produce a contradiction. And this exactly proves this first point of the theorem. So we're going to run in linear time because we're not going to produce a contradiction. We're going to find a satisfying assignment. Second, if we plug in C times P as the number of three clauses, we have C times 1 minus P, two clauses, and we solve. Well, what we see is that if we have slightly less than 1/2, two clauses, and at most 1/6 and three clauses, well, then we're not going to produce a contradiction. And this gives us this line. Because if we don't produce a contradiction, if unit clause finds a satisfying assignment, well, then the formula must be satisfiable. So that takes care of the first part. So now the second part was that we have to show that if we have more than two-thirds and three clauses, that we're going to get to this bad configuration where we have 1/2 minus epsilon and two clauses and slightly more than 1/6 and three clauses. And so all we have to do now is we take the same part we had before, but we just add an additional constraint here in that we want the three clauses to stay sufficiently large. Now we just start off again setting our initial conditions that at the start we have Cn, three clauses and no two clauses, and we show that as long as C is over two-thirds, then unit clause is always going to reach this configuration for the appropriate values of epsilon and delta. The appropriate values of epsilon delta come from the next step where we have to prove that such a configuration is unsatisfiable. The simplest way to prove something's unsatisfiable is to use what's called the first moment bound, which lets just count the expected number of solutions on the formula. That's easy enough. So if we have alpha n variables, well, there's d times alpha n possible ways to set these variables. And if you think of each constraint, there's beta n constraints. Each constraint, there's a 1 over d probability that it's going to satisfy that clause. So the expected number of solutions is just the product of this. Now, if beta is greater than alpha, then the expected number of solutions is little of 1. So we can use Markov's inequality, which says basically that you can bound the probability by the expected number. So if beta is greater than alpha, then the formula is almost surely unsatisfiable. Now, it doesn't take much math to see that 1 half plus 1 sixth is less than 1, so this configuration by itself is not, you know, the expected value is not enough. We can't show that it's unsatisfiable that way, but maybe it has a subformula which is dense enough that's going to be unsatisfiable. And actually, the subformula doesn't just have to be dense enough, it also has to be large. It has to be order n. So there was a talk earlier today on random graphs, which is nice, so I don't have to define a lot of these terms. But if you know a little bit about random graphs, you realize that a random formula, which we're modeling as a hypergraph, is going to have a lot of clauses that there's going to be a lot of clauses in it that has variables of degree at most 1. So there's going to be a lot of variables of degree 2. A lot of variables of degree 1, a lot of variables of degree 0. This is a problem because a variable of degree 1 can always be satisfied. Remember, we're uniquely extendable. You set two values, there's always a value for the third variable. Variables of degree 0 are trivially satisfied. So these variables are not going to affect the satisfiability of the formula. So what we have to do is trim them away. And if we trim them away, we get down to the 2-core, which was the core as was talked about in the random graphs. I call it 2-core just to be clear that we're dealing with the unique maximal subformula with minimum degree 2. Computing the size of the 2-core has been done before for graphs and for uniform hypergraphs. Lucek, I believe, was the first one to use the branching process, which is the technique that we're going to use. And Mike Malloy used it to do uniform hypergraphs, and now we just have to generalize this technique for these non-uniform hypergraphs where we have these mixed hypergraphs with clause sizes 2 and 3. And the idea of the branching process is that the probability a vertex is trimmed when you're reducing to the 2-core is the probability that all but one of its children are trimmed. So you're cutting away the vertices. So is the vertex going to survive or not? If it survives, it's because it has a lot of neighbors and those neighbors weren't cut. So this is you have to use this technique of the branching process to come up with these probabilities, and you end up with a theorem like this, which says that if we have a mixture formula of 2 clauses and 3 clauses, then we're going to have a 2-core where we can have the exact value for the size in terms of the number of variables, the number of 2 clauses in the 2-core, and the number of 3 clauses in the 2-core. You don't have to worry about the numbers here. It's just the point that we can compute this. And now what we just have to do is discover that for every delta, there exists an epsilon such that the number of edges in my 2-core is greater than the number of variables. Now, once we've done that, we know from Markov's inequality, this subformula is going to be almost surely unsatisfiable. And the other key point is that we have a linear number of variables. So here we have a formula that's unsatisfiable, and now DPL is going to backtrack out. Well, we have to show it's going to take a linear time to backtrack out of this formula. So we're going to show that it takes a linear time if the 2 clauses are satisfied, and we don't even care about the 1/6 anymore. We just need a linear number of 3 clauses, and we're going to be unsatisfied. Well, or it's going to take exponential time to backtrack out of an unsatisfiable formula. The way we do that is we know that DPLL is, it's well known that there's this link between DPLL and this, what's known as the resolution complexity of a formula. And you don't need to know what resolution complexity is because there's some very nice results that have been done in the last few years by Ben Sasson and Wiggerson, as well as by Mitchell and Malloy and Talavatipour, which shows that exponential resolution complexity is a consequence of these three facts holding. The first states that a minimal unsatisfiable formula has to be pretty large, so it's got to be order n. The second say that if we have a subproblem which is smaller than our minimal unsatisfiable formula, it's going to have a lot of variables of degree 1, or a degree at most 1. And the third states that their problem is extendable. Well, this third one holds trivially because our problem is uniquely extendable. We defined it that way. So all we have to do is show that every subproblem, that the minimal unsatisfiable formula has to be at least linear size, and that if we're smaller than that, we have a large number of variables of degree at most 1. And this is where it's exponential. It's exponential in these variables of degree 1. So the way we do this is by counting. we have to find a configuration that exists in every formula that has very few variables of degree one. And our configuration is just, let's look at the path on the two clauses. There's going to be some set of paths. Now, what's a bad thing can happen? Well, what can happen where we don't have a lot of variables of degree one? Well, one thing we can have a lot of very long paths, or also we can consider the endpoints of these paths. Well, they're going to be covered by the three clauses. So we have some sort of configuration where these, again, are going to have paths coming out of them. So we divide up all our vertices into paths, and we cover the ends of these paths by the three clauses. So the first note is that a minimal unsatisfiable formula must contain this configuration. Why? Because there are no variables of degree 1 or 0 in a minimal unsatisfiable formula. You can trim them away. The second step is that we prove that almost surely there cannot be a configuration on at most alpha n variables. So that proves the first part, which says that every subformula on at most alpha n variables is satisfiable because there cannot be this configuration. And this is just done by counting and using Markov's inequality. And the second one is that prove that if there's no such configuration on less than alpha n variables, then there's going to be a linear number of variables of degree at most one. And this is done by Chebyshev's inequality, again, by counting. And we're counting how many really long paths. Okay, if there's no such configuration, then you're going to have endpoints that are not covered. So how can there not be a linear number of variables of degree one? Well, that can only be if these paths get really long. So we're just going to count the number of long paths, use Chebyshev's inequality to bound the variance, and prove that there has to be a linear number. And that completes the proof. So, thank you.
Questions for Harold? The X or SAT?